I wonder if I might put a general and specific in play, but the general would be on the part of a skeptic who says, in listening to your paper, either you've committed the is-ought fallacy. You've committed the is-ought fallacy. Or you've smuggled a great deal of normativity into nature. And I don't know how you respond to that. Not being skeptic, but skeptical to raise that question. Now, to make things more particular, if you have, perhaps not smuggled, but perhaps quite properly assumed, a normativity in nature, it could be that the interest that so many have in the estimation of sex, especially on the part of Christians, in nature, has to do with a further view of the background, to wit, that normatively speaking, there's something amiss with our nature, which might be referred to as the fall. Now, here's a real, real specific. I wonder if you're aware of Thomas's claim that had there not been a fall, sexual ecstasy would be more ecstatic than it is now.
I was not aware of that.
I think that's a very fundamental insight from a Christian perspective. It seems to me anything to do with virginity has to do with really an anticipation of the kingdom rather than the denigration of sexuality. And I think that when you have a tradition as long as Christianity, there are things that don't get sorted out as well they might, as well as they might. I'd just like to offer one short citation from Dorothy Day.
Sure.
Who says, and this is in a book called On Pilgrimage, which we are on. Our beds may be altars at which we kneel to pray and on which we receive the sacrament of matrimony. Giving and receiving in a communion, which is a foretaste of the beatific vision. This is hardly any kind of denigration of sexuality. In fact, from Dorothy Day to the Song of Songs, Canticle of Canticles, the relationship between God and creatures is most highly presented in terms of ecstatic sexual love. So I think there's something wrong here if we find stray things, or even maybe not so stray things, in Augustine and Albigensianism and Manichaeanism, and attribute that to the larger Christian tradition.
Well, it does seem to be an ongoing theme, though. I mean, no matter how it's justified, I think part of the Christian tradition is suspicion of the body, rejection, and sometimes fear of physical pleasure.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot depends on your hermeneutics. If you read William James on the variety of religious experience, he says you might just as well think that mystics had some sort of improper obsession with air. They're forever talking about respiration, exaltation, inspiration. In fact, that wasn't it at all. It's just a fundamental metaphor.
I think we have to agree to disagree on that one, because I think there is a fundamental anxiety about sexuality in particular, that of all the sins, this is the one that causes the most anguish and concern. And we have inherited that. And now I think finally we're starting to talk about that and coming to terms with it. And I think that's a good thing.
Would you say that Foucault is perhaps an exemplar for us in coming to terms with it?
I mean, I really admire what he has written, his Volume 2 and Volume 3 of the History of Sexuality, just looking at these things from a new perspective is very helpful. And he has some, just some very provocative formulations there. So I would recommend those two works.
And yes. His support for the Man-Boy Love Association?
I don't know about that.
Why don't you follow out the implications of philosophical positions?
That may be an ad hoc man.
No, I don't think so.
Yes, sir.
When I read the Church Fathers, I read St. Augustine on sexuality and abortion, I think you have to read them in the world they were living in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were living in the Roman Empire, which had gone to great excess. And I think Chesterton, in his book on St. Francis, brings it on a different issue, how up until Francis, the Church was busy trying to correct the excessive worship of nature. They'd perhaps gone too far, but now Francis is able to affirm the goodness of nature. And I think the same thing is true of sexuality as such. What they were reacting to was what was going on with the orgies and so forth and trying to reaffirm. And then perhaps, the swing of the pendulum. And I think you have to read them in that context.
That's a good point.
And what I find interesting is we seem to be going more back to the other side of the swing of the pendulum. We may see another reaction of that sort.
No, I think that the quote that I read from Peter Brown is really astute, I think, that control of sexuality was, in fact, the way in which the early Christians differentiated themselves from the mainstream. So maybe it was originally a marker in that respect, but then it became, I think, something more punishing.
I think you read Thomas was influenced by Augustine, but Augustine was more influenced by what was going on in his day. This was the culture in which St. Benedict got disgusted with Rome and went out and talked to Mount Cassino eventually, because of Mount Subiaco originally, because he was disgusted with that whole culture. He just couldn't stand it anymore. It wasn't that he said that the world was bad, but this world was unbearable. He wanted no part of it. And same with the early monks. The vow of poverty that they made. It was not because poverty and riches are bad, but because they're good. You give up a good for a higher good. It's not you give it up because it's bad. Everyone's supposed to give up because it's bad. But you go beyond that. And I think it's the same thing with the vow of chastity. It wasn't at that point that chastity was bad. I mean, that sexuality was bad, but that there's a higher good. And you get the same problem, for instance, as to what's normal virtue and what's heroic, excessive virtue, almost. Because Mother Teresa of Calcutta, was she just doing what everyone's expected to do, or was she going beyond the call of duty? She's going to do a kind of heroic virtue. No, she's not saying that what we're all doing is bad, but there's a greater thing we could do if we had the sanctity to do it.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure if you are holding up Socrates as an example of temperance, but the kind of account of temperance you get there is nothing like what you want to give at the end of the talk. It's not that Socrates doesn't drink in the symposium, it's just that he's not affected by drink. And the reason he's not affected is that he's so successful at separating his mind from his body. And in fact, Socrates and Plato represent this otherworldly kind of view of the soul that is in fact responsible for the attitude that people have towards the environment, that you should not be concerned with this world because there's some other world that's more important. And also the idea that humans should use their reason to dominate and to control the environment, and this is what we see in industrialization and technology that has been so damaging, as in the examples you cited. So if Socrates is an example of temperance, it's very different. In fact, it's opposed to the kind of temperance you're talking about.
I'm impressed that Socrates will comment that he is full of these desires. It's just that he has managed to control them. So it's not that he's otherworldly. I don't think of him as otherworldly at all. But very much at home in the world, discussing philosophy in the marketplace with whoever is around. He doesn't try to remove himself from human society or escape the world.
Well, that's because he's in the cage. Yeah. I mean, there are times like when he stood on the porch and like he's not there. Right before the symposium on his way there. He's in some other world.
You may have a different meaning of Socrates then. So I see him as a very down-to-earth person.
So do you agree that there's this idea in Plato about using reason to control, and that has contributed to the attitude of humans to use technology to control the world?
Well, reason is an aspect, but it's not so much a tyrant. I mean, when he describes the constitution of the soul in those books of the Republic, there are definitely four parts, and temperance is one of those important parts, and it involves the agreement of all as to who is to rule. I don't see it as self-control in a confining, restrictive sense that maybe you get later with some of the early Christian thinkers. So I think it's a different kind of self-control.
So turning to, I think it's a sort of great insight that our sense of who we are is bound up with our sense of belonging to nature. The sort of relationship we have to our own bodies and to our appetites and so on is connected with how we're going to relate to nature. So if we're trying to dominate and tyrannize our own bodies, as it were, that's not going to help us to form a right relationship with nature. But your positive suggestion seems to be that with regard to ourselves, there should be some element of self-control, but it's basically attunement, and we should be attuning ourselves to nature.
Not just self-control, also self-love, I think. Okay. Because if there's self-hatred there, we're always going to feel alienated in the world around us.
But I'm just wondering, is there still then some kind of hierarchy of reason over the passions and of us over nature? Because, you don't want domination, but do you want something like stewardship? Or is it just a purely conforming to what's already there? Because my anxiety about just sort of attuning ourselves to what's already there is that what's already there is problematic at times. I mean, nature, we could idealize nature, but there's a lot that's wrong in nature anyway. And there are things that are wrong in ourselves. So if we just attune ourselves to them, it seems to me we still need some kind of hierarchy, even if it's a loving, respectful hierarchy. Something like stewardship might be better.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And this is a shorter version of the whole thing. I actually think that Kant has some really good things to say about our relationship to the natural world in terms of the idea of the sublime, for example. It is the moment when you recognize, first you're overawed by that which is outside of you, but then you recognize a sense of belonging to it. And it seems to me that something like that account perhaps could be extended to explain our belonging to nature. But yeah, stewardship, I mean, yes, completely. The details need to be filled in. Yes.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. The question is that I have is if you could comment a little bit more, and you were just getting into that, I think, about the relationship between an aesthetic appreciation of the world, which seems to be a lot of about seeing the world in a certain way, or seeing creation in a certain way, for example, as a totality and maybe with that sense of or of the sublime that you were just mentioning now from Kant, And how is that connected to temperance? That is the relation between the two, whether temperance is would be partly rooted in that kind of scene or aesthetic response to the world.
I'm thinking that the aesthetic response to the natural world is an essential aspect of temperance in the way that I described it in the second part of the paper. Mm-hmm. That you really have to be astonished by the natural world, just, you know, even overwhelmed by the possibilities of beauty that are there. And if that doesn't happen to you, I don't know how you can respond, how you can really be concerned about nature, unless it's, you know, just as a means to an end, and do I got to think of my grandchildren or something like that. But it's the astonishment of nature, perhaps as shown in the sublime, that really orients us to it and you know, gives us that sense of belonging and desire for stewardship and desire to care for it. So I see that as it's not just, you know, a separable thing, oh, nature's lovely, but wow, it's, we're connected. Yeah.
Well, one could also go partly wrong. I am thinking of Kant's denying that we should have any kind of care about animals, for example, because they don't have rights the way we do. And so you can have that reverence without that informing a proper response.
Reverence is important, and to humans and to non-humans and to nature itself. I think that must be the basis.
I loved your talk. I love the emphasis on joyful temperance, but it makes me want to learn the answer to this. Uh-huh. Temperance is joyful, right? I mean, a great way to sell it. I think people would get it if they got a taste of it. It's not. It's not that hard to maintain once you get a taste, right? If the person with the Ferrari has to wash every day, just knew what it's like to have a Hyundai, he'd find me dirty, right? He would probably learn the error of his ways. Yeah. And then the environmental efforts we make here—they can be easy too. I'm not very wealthy, and I notice I get a lot of compliments for some of the things I do as if they're big environmental efforts, you know, everything, lunch in a glass jar or something like that. It's easy to do the kind of, it's like good housekeeping, I think, that, right, doing the sort of environmentally friendly norms that are current here. What if temperance can't get us to solve problems like we have in the environment? And the problem really is one of justice and poverty in the world, and if the majority of the pollution that's being created now is from coal burning in second and third world countries, would temperance do very little? It's self-congratulatory, that would be the risk, right? Would temperance do very little to mitigate that problem? And so I'm just wondering, what are the limits of temperance in the environment?
That's a great question. I take it as this is one of the reasons why it's one of the four cardinal virtues, and that these virtues mutually support and illuminate each other. So could you have real courage without justice? I mean, what would that be like? Could you have that was a point that I came to in writing the book, just thinking of the various ways in which these virtues in particular support each other. So, I don't know if that's avoiding the question, but I think that's the answer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.